You're listening to The Jewish Truth Bomb with Lenny Goldberg.
Hey, this is Lenny Goldberg, and thank you for joining me today. 331 missiles fired on Israel. It could have ended a lot worse. As we say on Passover, HaKadosh Baruch Hu matzilenu miyadam. HaKadosh Baruch Hu saves us again. Now, having said that, when are we going to go on offense? You know, it's like, let's say you have a boxer who's really great at blocking punches. He's got really good defense. Obviously, at one point, he's going to have to punch back, because defensive prowess is only good if it's going to set up your offense. Because if we continue just to play defense, we'll just normalize these attacks the way we've normalized missiles on steroid from Gaza. Now, we have to ask, why is Iran launching missiles on us now? Well, 3 weeks ago, Israel eliminated some high-ranking Hezbollah leaders, the head of their Eastern Command. And since then, they've been talking about nekama. We're going to take vengeance. Israel's going to pay a price. And that's because they see a weak Israel. Because this isn't the first time we eliminated high-ranking Hezbollah commanders. But the problem is that Israel is now projecting to its enemies weakness. We look vulnerable. That's what October 7th has done. And Iran wants to join in on it. They see a window now where they can try to make Israel pay a price. 7 months ago, when Israel did the same thing, Iran didn't do anything, didn't say anything. So what happened? We lost our deterrent factor. So what they're doing is they're feeling us out. They don't want a full-scale war, at least right now. And so even though on Saturday night, there was a great panic here in Israel, it turned out not to be as scary as it seemed, because they're playing chess with us. They want to see our reaction. And for them, they can now say, you see, we avenged the assassination of our leaders. Let it be written in the books that we struck Israel. That's what they wanted. But the point is, they feel our vulnerability, because in this part of the world, in this region, the weak can't survive. The weak one doesn't have a chance, and we are perceived right now as being weak. That's how we're perceived by the Hezbollah, by the Hamas in Gaza. And that's why the Hamas says they don't want to make any deals right now. Why not? Because they feel they have the upper hand. They have the leverage. That's how it works in the Middle East. That's the mentality. And Rabbi Kahana talked about this all the time. Here he is speaking to a bunch of nice American Jews, explaining the Arab mentality, how it's only strength that they understand.
And that's the only language they understand. And for those nice Jews sitting here who say, that's terrible, let me just repeat what Moshe Aarons once said to a group of UJA givers in Jerusalem. One Jew got up and he said, why must there always be war? Why can't we sit down with the Arabs, coffee and cake, and we work the problem out? And he said, sir, this is the Middle East, not the Middle West. That's right, it's the Middle East. And that's what the Arabs know and understand. If you're good to them, you're not good, you're weak. And if you're weak, you're dead.
That's Rabbi Meir Kahana with another truth attack. Now, it's not just Iran and the Hamas that's emboldened by a weakness. So too are the Arabs in Judea and Samaria. This past Shabbat, they found the body of Binyamin Achimeir, a 14-year-old shepherd, Jewish shepherd, who was murdered by Arabs. And from Friday morning through Shabbat, thousands were searching for him. And everybody thought he was captured, because they just couldn't find his body. And finally found it. And what's strange is that it was only 200 meters from his farm in the Benjamin area. His farm was called Malachi Shalom. Actually, it was a drone that showed them where the body was. They didn't find it. They found it with the drone. His head was crushed by a giant rock. I don't think that part of the story you're going to get in the news. And during Shabbat, Motzei Shabbat, there were a lot of Jewish boys, God bless them, rioting. Arab property was torched. The Arab village of Duma and a couple others. There's a lot of people arrested now, including my son, Binyamin, chip off the old block. And Binyamin is the name of the boy who was murdered as well. So my Binyamin was arrested fighting for the honor of Binyamin Achimeir. And his mother, on Friday, before they found the body, made a heartbreaking plea for Am Yisrael to pray and to do good deeds. And maybe in that merit, they'll find her son healthy. But it didn't turn out that way. And listening to the rabbi's sermons on Shabbat in my settlement and reading the OU publications that came my way, the Orthodox Union, they have these nice magazines. We're talking about Zionists, lovers of Israel, true lovers of Israel, but they really have no answers. The articles, and there's so many of them and so well written, but it's all about coping through all this. And they're always finding the silver lining of October 7th somehow, the unity that's been created. A lot about unity. You know, I think unity might be overrated. I really do. I'm not really interested in unity. I'm interested in destroying the enemies of Israel. You know, we were unified in Treblinka too. All kinds of Jews together in a great show of unity. And at Auschwitz, we had Haredi Jews and secular Jews all together. Is that what we want? So all this talk about Jewish unity, unity with whom? With the left that hates Judaism to the very core? You want unity with the Jewish division of the Shin Bet, which arrests and tortures the Hilltop Youth? How about unity with the New Israel Fund, who work every day to destroy Israel? And these Hilltop kids who are getting arrested, who are taking the law into their own hands because they see the IDF can't protect them, they're going to get condemned. There won't be any unity for them. You know, sometimes you just have to choose. You can't have it both ways. We need a strong Jewish state that believes in God, that wipes out its enemies. And anything less than that guarantees disaster. So it's not an issue of unity. You know, sometimes you're going down a road and you reach a junction and you'd like to keep going straight, but you can't. You can only go right or left. You have no other choice. You can't go back, can't go forward. You got to choose. That's the point we're at right now. And the rabbis of the settlements, I know them well. Most of them are students of Rav Kook. They went to Har HaMor or Merkaz HaRav. And they'll never talk about vengeance. A lot of talk about the hostages, but nothing about the scum who took those hostages hostage. Who took them hostage? Aliens from Mars? It was the Hamas, the Arabs. It's the same thing, but they won't even talk about that. See, the problem of these Zionist rabbis who live in the settlements and the rabbis from the OU, they are the nicest people you're ever going to want to meet. That's the problem, though. They're too nice. This isn't the time to be nice. But we're talking about rabbis who were raised on the ideals of Avat Chinam and love and love. So they're not built for this. They're not built for this situation. They weren't trained for it. It's not in their skill set. They only know about love and unity. So they're not trained to hate, even to hate the enemy. They're not capable. They're wonderful souls, but the problem is they're chalavi. You know what I'm saying? Chalavi, milchik. You know, there's meat and milk. They're milk. We need meat. You know, we need carnivore rabbis, fire and brimstone rabbis who feel chilul Hashem in their bones. They feel that there's a creation of God's name in their bones. And when Jews are massacred like they were on October 7th, they're thinking, how can we rectify this chilul Hashem? How can we make it so this doesn't happen again? So the Orthodox Union and the rabbis of the settlements, they do absolutely nothing to stop the next October 7th. It's not in their messaging. It's not in their sermons. It's not in the articles they write. It's like they're trying to be politically correct while the Arabs in Gaza are chopping up the limbs of Jews and passing them out to sell. That's what's going on. Anyway, I'll talk more about the subject of Gaza later on. Moving on to something else. This past Monday was the solar eclipse. It was a big deal. The whole world was talking about it, commenting on it. A lot of people made fun of the fact that people care so much. What's the big deal if it's dark for a while? Just go into a room, shut the lights, and it'll be dark. Same thing. But according to our sages, there is a significance to the solar eclipse and the lunar eclipse. Because everything that God created, especially something as awesome as the moon and the sun, has significance and the symbolism behind it. The Talmud teaches us that a solar eclipse is a bad omen for the entire world because the world runs according to the solar calendar, goes by the sun. And a lunar eclipse, that's considered a bad sign for the Jews because we go by the moon, right? The day starts at nighttime, actually, for us. V'hi Erev, v'hi Boker. When do we start Shabbat? We start it on Friday night. So for us, the day starts at night because we go according to the moon. And therefore, an eclipse of the moon It's a bad omen for the Jewish people. And because the sun represents the rest of the nations, a solar eclipse is a bad omen for the rest of the nations. Because what we call nature, the nature that got implanted in this world, is a manifestation of spiritual matters. And the fact that every once in a while you have a solar eclipse or a lunar eclipse, that is representative of the eternal struggle between Israel and the nations. And so a solar eclipse symbolizes an eclipse of the nations. They're getting eclipsed. They're getting covered by the moon, by the Jews. We're on top for a few seconds anyway. And that's why, as I said, the solar eclipse is a good omen for the Jewish people. Now, what does it mean by a good omen? Think of it as something similar to what we say about the month of Adar, that let's say the Jew, he has a court case. Try to have it that the trial falls in the month of Adar, because on the month of Adar, it's auspicious for good things to happen. On the other hand, in the month of Av, try not to have a court case in the month of Av. That's a bad omen. Now, does that mean that the Jew is going to triumph all the time during the month of Adar and he's always going to lose in the month of Av? No, but it's just that God determined that there are certain times that are more auspicious than other times. Or they have the segula, as they say. Which means what? That if the Jew makes an effort and does the best he can, prepares himself the way he should, then he's got a really good shot to be successful. If it's in the month of Adar or during a solar eclipse, then he has a really good shot at success. And so if Israel, during the solar eclipse, they made effort, they took some proactive steps in the right direction, even a small step, to show a little bit of faith, that would probably be good enough to bear fruits and deliver a blow to the enemy. But if we insist in going in the wrong direction, and if we continue to bring to Gaza, to our enemy, trucks of humanitarian aid and buckling to the pressure and not taking the steps that we can take, like, for instance, shutting off their electricity, shutting off their water, or how about a preemptive strike on Iran instead of waiting for them to strike us first? There are things we can do. If we did those things, and there was a solar eclipse, now you're talking. But we don't do anything. We don't take those steps. So with our own hands, we turn the solar eclipse into a lunar eclipse. Because at the end of the day, it's up to us. It's not like a magic wand. Oh, there's a solar eclipse. Now everything's going to be okay. Oh, it's the month of Adar. Wow. The Kodesh Baruch Hu is going to strike down our enemies with a bolt of lightning. It doesn't work that way. If we don't take advantage of what God already gave us, through his great kindness and through these miracles, that we have the power and we have a military, that throughout the exile, we can only have dreamed of something like this. Yet we stand crippled before the world, Nebuch, not taking the steps we should take. Then we have nobody to blame but ourselves. Because at the end of the day, what really matters is the free choice. Free choice, Bechira Chofshit. What we do is worth more than all the segulot and all the good luck charms and all the solar eclipses in the months of Adar. What we do, that's what makes the impact. And all the rest of it is gravy. If you do it during that time, then good things should happen. But first you have to do. I want to move on and talk about Passover. It's coming up real soon. And I want to read the opening paragraph of an article that Rabbi Kahana wrote, which really epitomizes and, you know, makes fun of the modern Western Jew who, on one hand, he observes the rituals. On the other hand, he tries to balance that with his Western values and his American lifestyle. So now he's going to explain how a typical modern Jewish family is at the Seder. And it says like this: it is the night of the Seder, the eve of Passover. The Jewish family is gathered around the table. The room is filled with people, including Gentile guests, gushing over the fascinating Jewish holiday. The family has equipped itself with Haggadahs so as to do the thing properly. They have finished the meal, and now the excited youngster, Scott, Brian, Kevin, or some other Jewish name, excitedly says, "It's time to open the door for Elijah." He comes to every Jewish house. The parents smile. The Gentiles smile. How similar to Santa Claus. And of course, they all arise as the child rushes to open the door. Jew and Gentile alike chant the words prescribed by the Haggadah, the biblical words of the Psalms that proclaim, pour forth your wrath upon the nations that do not recognize you, and upon the kingdoms that do not invoke your name. For they have devoured Jacob and destroyed his habitation. Pour forth your fury upon them and let your burning wrath overtake them. Pursue them with anger and destroy them from beneath the heavens of the Lord. My God, what to think? What do the Gentiles in the room think? What a litany of anger and above all, vengeance? An open prayer and call for the Almighty to avenge himself upon the nations, to destroy them for what they do to Israel? Is this Judaism? And did not the rabbi, the temple paragon of Jewish wisdom, admonish us that Jews oppose vengeance, that it's not a Jewish concept? And isn't that why we're supposed to feel ashamed at the conduct of the Israeli army? And above all, what will John and Kathy, the Gentile neighbors, think about Jews, about us? Anyway, the article goes on explaining the contradiction, really, between many concepts of Judaism and the Western culture, that is America, that most Jews are used to. It just doesn't always jibe together. But that's how it is in the Reform, conservative. It's a fraud that was created by the counterfeiters of Judaism. They created a fraud, a counterfeit Judaism, that make it palatable to their neighbors. And me personally, I never really had a Seder like that, but I did go to a Seder. It was probably the only religious ceremony I fulfilled, that twice a year, two nights of the Seder, we'd drive to the Bronx, me and my family, and we'd have a Seder. My Aunt Hinder and her husband, they were from that generation that came from Europe to the shores of America, and they still observed Jewish customs. And of course, it wasn't very meaningful. All I remember really is that the Knick playoff games were always on at that time. So like on the radio, you could hear the Knick games. And I probably ate cheeseburgers at White Castle during Passover. I didn't really know anything about it. You know, my only contact with any Orthodox Jew, the first time I saw any Orthodox Jew is when I saw Rabbi Kahana, when he came to my campus, and that kind of blew me away and changed my direction. But really, that's the worst thing when you have counterfeit Judaism. It's better nothing at all than having this watered-down parv Judaism that's been served to us by the conservative and reform movements. And so getting back to real Judaism, I want to read something from the Haggadah of the Jewish idea, something kind of deep. It's the part of the Haggadah where it says, and Hashem, he saw our affliction. What affliction? And the Haggadah says, this refers to the violation of marital life. In Hebrew, prishut derech eretz, that the Egyptians didn't let the Jewish man sleep with his wife. He didn't allow intimacy. And the Haggadah continues, as it says, and God saw the children of Israel, and God knew. So what does this all mean? That God saw this violation of marital life, that the Egyptians were not letting the men be with their wives, and he saw that, and God knew. So I'm going to read the commentary here by Binyamin Zev Kahana, first explaining, how did the Egyptians violate marital life? What did they do? So it says like this, throughout the time of the slavery and the affliction, the Egyptians tried to prevent conjugal relations within Jewish families, both to prevent natural growth and also because the Egyptians, who were mired in sexual depravity, wanted to take the Jewish women for themselves. And that's what it means when it says in the Gemara that the Egyptians would force the men to do women's work and the women to do men's work. Why? Why did they do that? See, the goal was to degrade the men in their wives' eyes so that the women wouldn't love their husbands anymore. They'd lose respect for them. They wouldn't want to sleep with their husbands. There would be no more intimacy between the man and the wife. And that would cause the families to disintegrate. And by the way, that same process is occurring in the Western culture, where we also have a disintegration of the institution of marriage and breakup of families and men marrying men and all that sickness. Okay, so the Egyptians humiliated their husbands so they wouldn't want to be with their wives. And by the way, that happens, you know, in the Gush Katif dismantlement. After that whole disengagement where the Jews were thrown out of their houses, there were lots of divorces, many, many divorces after, because what happened? The family was thrown aside to some other place. The husband wasn't working anymore. And that created tension in the household, because as long as the husband is working, he's going out, he's bringing home the bread, he's a man, and therefore he can be with his wife. But if you take that away, he starts to feel inadequate, and it creates problems of shalom bayit. But here's the part that really doesn't make sense. It says, and God knew. Because it appears strange to link the phrase, and God knew, with the separation of husbands and wives. Because the expression to know is connected with conjugal relations. as it says, Adam knew his wife Eve. So in the Bible, when you know somebody, you know them biblically, right? It means you're together with them in intimacy. But what's the connection here where it says, and God knew? And this is what Binyamin Kahana says in his commentary, that the central theme of the Exodus from Egypt is the struggle of the arrogant Pharaoh who said, Lo yadati et Hashem, I don't know Hashem. And of course, the purpose of these plagues is so he'll know Hashem. Anyway, the Egyptians tried to exterminate the nation of God and thereby the knowledge of God, Yediat Hashem, to know God, which is expressed how? Through the existence of the nation of Israel. And they're trying to exterminate God's nation by taking the Jewish women for themselves. They forced their husbands to remain in the fields at night, thus distancing them from their wives, and in various other ways, as we mentioned, to try to prevent them from being together to have children. But what happened? We know that the righteous Jewish women in Egypt didn't fall into the trap that the Egyptians set for them, but they remained faithful to their husbands under these conditions. What would they do? They would go out into the fields and they would make themselves up and put on perfume, and they would take mirrors. And with these mirrors, they lay with their husbands and they would tempt them and they seduced them, and they were together with their husbands and they had children. And later on, when the Jews built the tabernacle and everybody brought a contribution, the women brought these mirrors, the mirrors that they used to seduce their husbands. That was their contribution to the sanctuary. And what happened was Moses rejected them. He said, no, that's not Sanua. Those mirrors we use for the Yetzer Hara. God, however, instructed Moses to accept these mirrors. And he said that these mirrors were the most beloved of all the donations to the tabernacle. Him chivivim alai. Why? Because they caused many holy Jews to be born in Egypt. And so now we can see the profound connection between marital relations, that is a Jew knowing his wife, and knowing God. Because by a Jew knowing his wife, it creates Yediat Hashem, it creates knowledge of God, which is exactly what the Egyptians were trying to prevent. So that's the answer to Paro's Lo Yadati Et Hashem, I don't know God. Oh, you're going to know him. You're going to know him through the plagues, and you're going to know them when the Jewish man knows his wife, and they're going to have a lot of Jewish babies, which will magnify the Yediat Hashem in the world, the knowledge of Hashem. And so for today as well, it's very important to have lots of Jewish babies. You know, there's a real plague going on, especially in the cities of America, where you have these Jewish men who never get married, never have offspring. There's no Jewish babies. There's no Jewish children. Where's the next generation going to come from? Eligible Jewish men are marrying Asian women. They can't find a nice Jewish girl. I have a good friend, Bob Seedy. He's one of those transplanted New Yorkers who had to flee New York for Florida because New York has become a toilet. He keeps telling me, he says, Lenny, you got to tell the Jews to have babies because we are disappearing over here. And we see from this that more Jewish babies is more Yediat Hashem in the world, because more Jews mean more of the people of Hashem. And the world can only know Hashem if there's a Jewish people to carry his word. But of course, it's upon us to be good Jews and do what Hashem wants us to do. And then we can be a light unto the nations, and there'll be Yediat Hashem in this world. And with Passover coming up, one can't talk about Passover without talking about the Sabbath that precedes this Passover. That's this coming Shabbat, the Shabbat HaGadol, the Great Sabbath. Because in it, you have the ultimate message of the Exodus from Egypt and of Passover itself. See, Shabbat HaGadol, it commemorates a basic lesson of Judaism, and that's real, rock-solid faith in God, who we really believe is greater than the mighty Pharaoh. Shabbat HaGadol is when the Jews sacrificed the first Paschal lamb, and it's written about in Exodus chapter 12. It says, speak to the assembly of Israel, on the 10th day of this month, they shall take for themselves, every man, a lamb. So the Jew has to take a lamb and bind it up for 4 days. And that's not a simple commandment, because the lamb wasn't just an animal. It was the very God of Egypt. And every Jew takes this lamb, the Egyptian God, they're taking the deity of their masters and tie it to their beds and bind it up. And the outraged Egyptian master looks at this and says, what are you doing? And we say, oh, we're going to shecht your lamb soon. We're going to slaughter your lamb, your deity, your God, and we're going to eat it. Hey, what happened to religious tolerance, right? Well, what's the point of this Korban Pesach? And again, that's the name of the holiday, after the sacrifice. Well, after the plagues, it's true that The Egyptians might have believed in God, but they didn't believe that he is the God, the only God. They think, oh, the God of Israel is pretty good, but that doesn't mean there aren't other gods too. So God has to show them that there is no other gods. It's not like the God of Israel is just having a good day, or he's on the uppity up, while the other gods are having a bad day. No, no. We're commanded to take their deity, their God, and to humiliate it. That is the Shabbat HaGadol. That's the Korban Pesach. That's what it represents. And so that's what Passover is really all about. It's to affirm to the world and to ourselves that the Lord, the God of Israel, he is, he exists, he is the one, the only one, and there is no other. And that the Gentile has no relevance to Jewish faith. That the pharaohs of all time, the ones in Egypt and the ones in Washington, they are utterly irrelevant to what will be with the Jew. So the goal of the Paschal Lamb is to humiliate their religion, to show that their deity doesn't exist. Because when we say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, Hashem is one, that means God is one. There is no other. So we're talking here about a religious struggle. And that is so relevant for today, because today we're not fighting the Hamas in Gaza. Our enemy isn't the Hamas. They're just the shaliach. They're the envoys of the Muslim world. The entire Muslim world in the United States, all the Muslims all over the world, in Qatar, the Hamas represents them. The Hamas is their shaliach. And through October 7th, they are realizing the dream of Islam. What's the dream of Islam? To wipe out the Jews, to cut off our limbs, to rape, to burn and burn and burn. That's what they do. And that's what they did on October 7th. And that's what they want to do in Tel Aviv. And so this has nothing to do with Gaza or the Hamas. It's a war against Islam. So think about that as you eat your afikomen, which of course is a remnant to the Paschal Lamb. That's it for me. Don't forget to listen to my classes in Tanakh, Lenny Goldberg's Bible Classes. It's a podcast on Spotify and other platforms. Have a wonderful Passover. May we merit a speedy redemption, a redemption of Shfoch Chametcha L'Goyim. Pour out your wrath upon the nations who did not know you. May God, through his people Israel, exact vengeance on our enemies. And until then, I'll see you next time.